Time to say hello to the citizen lobbyist, and she's going to say...
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you, too.
It's all about that today, hearts and flowers and very good chocolate.
Oh, right. Have you already indulged in chocolate this morning?
I did get some chocolate. I haven't indulged, but I did receive a nice bouquet of red roses yesterday, which is one of my favorites, and chocolate today, so it's already getting off to a good start.
And there's still more. I mean, the day still goes on.
I know. All weekend. What are you talking about?
Okay, so out there in the world, as people pause to celebrate Valentine's Day and indicate their love for one another, down at Juneau, life goes on. And I'm wondering, let's start there. Let's start at a distance. Yes, what's happening?
Well, a lot is percolating along. I've had my ear to the ground a little bit, mostly about education, because it seems like there's a lot of bills in play that you're not hearing a lot about education right now, but there's certainly a lot of committee hearings being held. There was a pretty substantial one yesterday that I listened to the bulk of that was a joint education meeting with the House members on House education members. Of course, that's headed up by Lynn Gaddis, our legislator here from the Kinnick area of the Valley. And on the Senate side is past Senate President Gary Stevens from Kodiak. So the joint committees came together yesterday and heard a bit about the success, or at least the benchmark report, on the last year's pass, I think it was last year's, the Alaska Performance Scholarship that, of course, was kind of a hard-fought battle in, I believe, last year's legislature that the governor set forward. And so they've got a little data. This was part of passing the bill that they needed to report to the legislature on how it was doing. And it was, I'll have to go back. I intend to download the packet with it because it was might have been something if you were seeing the PowerPoint presentation, but listening to it was kind of like listening to paint dry.
Okay. I understand that.
But they did talk a little bit about, most people have heard about it, probably forgotten that there were three certain things for eligibility of this Alaska Performance Scholarship. This was one of the ways, I believe, Governor Parnell thinks he wants to push money to education in alternative, what might be more successful ways. And the eligibility for this last year was they had to complete their curriculum, and there was a phased-in required curriculum that started in 2011 that'll go through 2015. They had to have a grade point average, a minimal grade point average in high school of about 2.5, and then they had various scores that they had to do well on, and that was the SATs, the ACTs, and the work keys. Mm-hmm. And those were the three bit of criteria that they had to measure up. And it's interesting because I guess I didn't know until yesterday that they don't always are able to report all the data they get from schools. A lot of these smaller schools that just have a couple kids, mm-hmm. Because of privacy acts, and everybody could kind of figure out who's who. I think the minimum is over five students, four or five students that you can really release hard data on. But they feel, or it sounds like they feel, that it's been pretty well received. There were 48 of the 54 districts that were able to apply for this. 42 used the scholarship. Of course, the bulk of them came from Anchorage. Second was Fairbanks, and then our own borough in Kenai. And I didn't really look down as far as how many where, but it was divided out there. And they talked about, there were some interesting questions asked. A couple things I didn't know about it. I think Representative Ledoux, who has been on the Senate in a past time or on the House before, kind of was gone for a while.
And but she was from Kodiak.
Right. Yeah, and she's back on the House of Representatives in the Anchorage, from the Anchorage area now.
Right.
And she wanted to know, could they use it at out-of-state colleges? And that was a big no. This is built basically to stay in state and have educations gotten here, basically. And that was part of it, was to feed sort of the university system, bulk that up a little bit. And so the intent is that it stays here. I was curious to hear them report that kids that go out of state, the two states that get most of our college out of state kids are from Washington and Oregon. But again, this Alaska Performance Scholarship is intended for just Alaskan schools. And then someone asked, I believe it was Mr. Dunleavy, who is a senator now from the Valley, new senator from the Valley, wanted to know what colleges really could it use for besides, you know, the University of Alaska. What other colleges did it apply for? And apparently there's an index in this report that lines up all the colleges, but he wanted to know specifically if it could be used for things like Wayland Baptist and APU and other private colleges. Mm-hmm. And he was told yes, that that money can be directed there, which right away got a response from the House member Ledoux, who asked, you know, constitutionally, how does that work out? We have a division of church and state, not supposed to have public monies going for private use like that, and how does that, you know, work out?
Well, I think the interesting question is whether and the division, you mentioned two institutions, Wayland Baptist and college, and Alaska Pacific University. And the interesting thing about that is I think, and it would be a good thing to bring representatives from both of those institutions in to have them mm-hmm. talk a little bit about whether they can be lumped together in a category or whether there are differences between those two.
Right.
Because Alaska Pacific University, although it's a private school, just as Harvard is a private school, and I recognize Harvard is not here in Alaska, but it may be different than an institution which is tied and has requirements specifically to some religious group.
Right. You know, they did talk about the fact that, you know, historically that the not the scholarship, because it's new, but as far as financial aid has gone mm-hmm. from the state, which is something has to be paid back, of course, that historically it has been given to these schools. But they also said in the same breath that the constitutionality is not really resolved, which means, you know, kind of is sort of shorthand for no one's challenged it yet, no one's sued yet. So I guess, you know, that was an interesting conversation that's come up now. You know, is it a precursor to the conversation that they're going to have? In fact, I think Senator Stevens said that. You know, this is going to be a conversation we're going to have about vouchers. So I think he didn't really want to get in too far into the weeds with it. But it certainly is on people's minds, I think. And but they went on to go ahead and talk about it. They're really not going to know how this is done, I think, too much until some longer data comes out. There are certainly people on the body that are concerned that it's only going to one caliber of students, maybe students that don't need the aid as much. And how is it being divided out to the lower range students that maybe didn't do so well in high school, but then a lot of very successful people didn't do very well in high school. So it's, I think there's probably, this may be the only report they give this year, but you'll probably hear this again next year, and they'll have a little more data to crunch. And I think they, by the sounds of things, the sitting legislators felt that it was kind of an unwieldy report, too. So they may drill down how they're presenting it and make it a little more, a little easier to digest, perhaps.
Okay, well, thanks for that. That's a good kickoff to the beginning of the Citizen Lobbyist report about what's happening from Juneau. So we did a little bit of education talk down there from the standpoint of monies for scholarship at the post-secondary level. What's next?
Well, there's a long list of bills, really a full page of bills outstanding. I kind of waded through a little of them last night. They're hearing some of them now. They're in various committees sponsored by various people. Thought we'd hit some of the ones that, you know, may get a lot of discussion on it. A couple I didn't really know were out there. One was a four-day school week that's been sponsored by Peggy Wilson and Tammy Wilson, a House member from Petersburg and one from Fairbanks. And this is a pilot program. They want to they're seeing if they can get any support on for just a four-day school week and how that – I'm not sure. They haven't really talked about it yet, so I'm not sure other than a very short talk or a little description about it, exactly what their intent is, if it's cost savings, they think that a longer school day and less school day is a better setup. Is it really good for all communities or maybe smaller districts? But it sounds like they just want to pick a district and perhaps see how it goes. And so that was kind of a surprise to me. I didn't know that was up. There's a couple of bills around. One that's getting probably the most attention right now, HB 27, which is a student count estimate. This is brought forward by Mr. House Member Feige, who is, I think, just has a little bit of Mat-Su area, and House Member Costello.
But an important part, since our transmitter sits in right smack dab in the middle of
right,
this place.
There you go. And they've brought through, it's a very convoluted, hard to explain way that funding is done that includes how they count the kids. And there's a couple of different counts that go through, and they want to somehow simplify that sort of change when the count is done, which will change a little bit on when the money is available. They feel that it'll give more certainty to the districts about what they're going to get. I've heard a little bit of testimony on that. I think they kicked it back for some more work. Part of this particular bill also has some language in it having to do with reserve funds and how much at the end of the year, for instance, in Mat-Su, whatever funds are left over, they must, by ordinance from the Mat-Su borough, divide 50-50. 50% goes back to the borough and 50% goes back to the school district. And there's been a lot of conversation and push and pull on that. The school district's very concerned they're not allowed to keep a fund balance. This bill actually by state statute raises the amount of fund balance they're able to keep by state regulation up to 15%. Mat-Su hasn't been able to keep near that amount just because of the own local ordinance.
Sure.
So this would instruct municipalities and boroughs to say you can't do that anymore. You must give educational money back to the educational body. Now, this one is they're going to stand a little head-to-head on this one locally, and it's been very respectful, but the school district very supportive of this. They've outlined many, many times the importance to having a reserve balance to kind of smooth out the bumps in the road. Anchorage has been very successful able to do that because they've been permitted by their own city government to do that. The borough, not all that happy with that arrangement. Mayor DeVilbiss has been equally outspoken about he doesn't feel that that's the right way to go.
Sure.
And so I think we're going to have some conversation on that a little bit more, and we'll see how, once they do some rewrites of this, how that comes back. But that could go through this year. This first year it's been introduced. Normally it takes a couple years, but two sessions. But this one could slink its way through and have some impacts on our district.
And the curious thing about it is the one piece that when you lift up the cover you see is that 50% that goes back to the borough. As I remember, it didn't just go into the borough general fund. It was supposed to go into the monies available for site selection purchases.
It does go back now to 50% to the school site selection fund. There's a cap on the fund. I think they can keep up to somewhere $5 million. And it's been edging up there.
Right.
And they've never really exceeded it. And so the question hasn't been, where does it go? But that was the intent of the legislation, probably about 2006, 2007 that came through, that said, look, we need to be planning for these future sites. And so we're going to set aside. You can keep half of it. I think last year it was somewhere around $278,000 that they split That was half of each that went to the fund. But that fund was also set up before the last bond was passed, that and it was brought to the attention of the school district and the borough that they could be bonding for land, and at low, low interest rates, perhaps that was the best use to do it. So when these bonds went through in October of last year, 2010 or 2011, they included the cost of the land in that to be reimbursed 70-30 from the state. So a little bit has changed. So it could be argued that site money is still important to have because future schools are going to be needed. It allows them to have the cash flow to go ahead and purchase those sites before it goes out to bond. This site has also been used for charter schools. Academy Charter was given almost $1 million out of it to secure a piece of property to put an expansion on. So,
and that's the interesting question that still sort of lingers. The clarification when monies are drawn from that site selection fund to purchase property for the charter school, it's still property that's owned by the borough. It's not owned by the charter school.
Right.
And right. Sometimes there's a confusion about that because there are some examples of charter schools that do a design build. And the question is whether the charter school community owns any of that capital, or does it all belong to the borough? I'm thinking of particularly a charter school over in Wasilla.
Birch Tree?
No. Beyond that.
Midnight
Sun.
To my knowledge, the only one that's really the land is owned by the borough would be Academy Charter and the future land for the Frontera School that they haven't received funding.
What about the building structures themselves?
I don't believe they own any of that. Birch
they
Tree,
being the charter school.
Right, right. They're leased facilities. Now, Birch Tree Charter probably is the newest one. It was designed with them in mind, but it's a private ownership, and they pay a very hefty lease
Any of these, and that's why it's something we have to look at, because my memory is that Midnight Sun was a design build lease to own arrangement.
So I'd
have to look into that to see whether, although it was built by a private property, it was leased that over a period of time, that you would have this kind of hybrid that would allow you to actually own the facility when all was done. But that's kind of in any case, I just...
I kind of think that may not be the case, because I think there's been some talk about these charters buying their existing facilities.
Right.
And buying them out. But I'm under the impression that at this point, all but Academy Charter are owned by private owners, and they are leased. Now, the LIO, above the LIO, the new correspondence school, mm-hmm. is a private ownership. It's just been totally redone. It's quite a lovely facility now. That was the expense of the owner of those leasehold improvements and passed on, of course, to the charter in
And of course, that's probably what we really need to do, is to have someone who's very familiar with all of the financial arrangements specifically around those buildings, because in the rest of the district, it's pretty clear the borough owns the buildings and the land, and the school district operates. In the charter school situation, because of the, as you're rightly describing, most arrangements being a lease of private property. The question arises over a long period of time, is that an efficient way to operate?
Right, and this has come up. This has come up recently a lot because, of course, you know, Frontier Charter School was in a building that their lease was going to expire, and they're very anxious to get out of that facility. It doesn't meet their needs really, and they went through quite an arduous process to just get the okay to get the land to build a facility on, which they ended up getting as part of borough-owned land, so there was no money exchange there. They had to redesignate some land. It's the intent is for it to go over near where the maintenance facility is now and where the new Matsu Day School will go, and they've redesigned the land there so that they feel they can serve three of those facilities. I think there's some 60 acres there owned by the borough. But they had to go through quite an arduous process to get the okay to do that. Now they're still looking for money. I believe that's a legislative priority right now, and ask, so to speak, direct from the district to the legislature for that building to get started on that. Academy has been the recipient of a lot of asks. They started receiving money in about 2004. They received $100,000 to kind of get started. That was a borough piece of land with some portable buildings in there. I think maybe Fish and Game or somebody, some portion of the borough was housed there. They weren't really using it. So that's how they started out. And then in 2005, they got $2.5 million from a direct appropriation from the borough or from the legislature.
So the real question that comes to my mind is, as the discussion goes on about different entities than, say, the school district being able to charter locally, that is there any case where an individual's charter school owns either the land or the buildings thereon separate from the school district? Do we have any example of that? Or is that something that would potentially happen? Because if you're going to have an entity that's going to be, say, a nonprofit that's going to operate a charter school, and that the authorizing body is not a governmental entity, then I would see room in there for the ownership of really what makes the school, the place of the school, being in a different category than anything we've ever done before.
Right, and that's kind of what's happened in the lower 48. A lot of schools have been closed. Older schools have been closed. And then they've been revived with these private corporations of non-charters have bid to either a lot of different arrangements exist, but either to buy or to lease these facilities back. We just haven't got to that point yet. All of our charter schools are public schools. That should be said several times over. They, if you look on the borough or the school district website, there's 11 of them listed as non-traditional schools, but they are all part of the public school system. But, you know, there's also a lot of conversation about what's fair and what's, you know, what's parity, so to speak. And there is, I mean, there are some very unequal arrangements just even within the non-traditional schools. And so that is a conversation that they should be having. And I think you're going to hear probably more and more about that. One of the bills on this long list of bills is about charter schools. And how we do that arrangement with them, and whether it's a decision that's made on the local level of who does the charter schools. Of course, there is the state deeds or Department of Early Development basically dictates how charter schools are done within the state. And but local entities or local school districts have had a lot of input on how that's done and who that is that these nonprofits are. And it sounds like the shift is now more of a state shift about how those decisions are going to be made. It's interesting. I discovered last night I was looking for some other information, and it was interesting to find out that there is now active lobbyist in the state for charter schools that is the same lobbyist that's hired by the Matsu Borough, not the school district. The school district has their own lobbyist. But Mr. Harris, who is past House member representative, is now the lobbyist and registered in the state to represent the Foundation for Educational Choice, which is an outside corporation, nonprofit. Been around. I haven't done a lot of research on him. They're very much into the open market way of educating. I don't know how. They have 14 people in faculty. They've been around since 1996. I don't know what their track record is or where they're at. They're from Indianapolis. But they must be interested in making some inroads here since they've hired a lobbyist here in town or here very local to represent them on this. So the foundation and the brook or the path is being set here, and we could have some big changes in the way we administer public education, it would seem.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of education bills and stuff coming up. What else has the legislature been up to?
What else has the legislature been up to? We heard a lot about cruise ships and waterways this week, didn't we?
Yes. Defining what is the level of pollution that's acceptable.
Right. A lot of push and pull. It's interesting. A lot of these big changes really get some interesting bedfellows together, don't they, over certain things. And there's a lot of proponents of salmon that are standing where they normally didn't stand next to environmentalists and saying, hey, what's the deal? We're all worried about our salmon supply here. They had quite a battle yesterday on the House about this, on the Senate floor, about this. They had one previous. The House has already passed it out. But the Senate had quite a battle yesterday, and they delayed it to the 19th of February.
It wasn't a slam dunk. It wasn't.
No, and I was kind of surprised they took that action. But I think by all reports, there's a huge amount of backlash coming on this to say, wait, this was a voter initiative. It's been just 2 years ago. It would seem the only one that's really wanting to change it is Princess Cruises, which is the biggest cruise company around. The voters should have more chance to have it in there. We're willing to make a few tweaks to it that won't make it so arduous, but to throw the baby out with the bathwater is not the vote, the intent of the voter. And you ignore the public at your own peril sometimes. And
that's right.
So I think we're seeing a little bit of that, and that has been taking a lot of air out of the room the last couple, at least this week, right?
Right, and you've been watching this on, of course, Gavel to Gavel. So
right.
You can almost feel that you're there and able to hear what's being said and all the rest. It would appear that the thoughts people had that once the election just passed occurred, and it appeared that the Senate majority that had a coalition that had existed was broken up, that things were going to be happening more in conjunction with what the House was thinking. But you're suggesting that there are still individual senators, different groups that are represented, that suggest that things aren't going to just pass right through.
Right. We're about 30 days into a 90-day session. That's the first go-around. There's always room for longer sessions, which has been sort of the habit the last couple of times around. It seemed like it was at a very, very quick pace, but, that's the easy part. Now they're getting into new bills being introduced. They're getting into more people showing up in the Capitol with different ideas for what more special interests. I think it is harder. There is definitely, even though one party controls both the House and the Senate, there's a little bit of seemingly more, and this is not something that's not going on nationally, a little division within that party of ideology, so to speak. So I think it has sort of surprised everyone that some of these things aren't exactly the slam dunk. And I think, Gavel to Gavel has really done an amazing service. They not only have live telecast of all day long, as much as you can stand, of all these hearings. There's just been just amazing amount of coverage on the oil tax, of course. Mm-hmm. But they've been able to, on their website, you can now go and download their committee meetings. That's what I did yesterday. I had to leave in the middle of the joint meeting, and I went back and listened to that last night, what I missed. So, yeah, they're providing another public, just as Radio Free Palmer is. Radio Free Palmer is a public service, public television. And so they've really done a good job of opening that up. And it's funny, last year I heard a few referrals from people. For the people listening on Gavel to Gavel, you practically don't hear a hearing now that someone says, for the people at home watching Gavel to Gavel.
Okay.
So I think the sunlight is in the window for sure. But having said that, look, they don't have to meet with the Opens Meeting Act like our local legislators and school district are supposed to act by. They do a lot of meeting in closed doors. This is just a snippet of what goes on. Mm-hmm. They also have a service now called Ledge TV. It's not on television like it would be on Channel 7 or cable here, but you can stream meetings. So some of the smaller meetings that maybe aren't covered by Gavel to Gavel, Ledge TV is now doing committee meetings. So there is just a plethora of things that you can tune into to listen. And I think the public is demanding it, just as they're enjoying and participating highly in Radio Free Palmer, doing the school board and assembly meetings. People want to know.
Right, right.
Location
that's
not stopping
thing.
Them.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, any other little bits and pieces here? I know you could go on, especially as you've mentioned the oil taxes and so on, but what we focused on are some things that I think certainly in the education arena will have an impact one way or the other here in the Valley. Any other specific things?
One more about the legislature that I think is one to watch. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of them. A House member Lynn and Lideau brought through an authorization for firearms in school. I think we're going to have a conversation on that. My interview with the governor a few weeks ago, he didn't sound like he was all that excited about that. Someone asked him point blank about that, so to speak, and he said, well, you know, we've taken a lot of safety precautions. We've really repped up our game. He didn't sound like he really wanted to wade into that water. So we'll see where that goes. It's pretty much an overall conclusion, sadly, that there may not be any raise in the base student allocation again this year. They didn't do it last year. There has been some one-time energy money given last year and this year that is, sort of sad. It goes into the general fund. It's less trackable, really, than the base student allocation. I think it's kind of a lousy way to do business myself, but that may be all that they get.
Mm-hmm.
So there is still highly a big push for that. The Alaska School Board Association has been down there really pushing on that. There's a couple of bills kicking around. So that could change. But I think that's one to watch. I'm not sure about this one. There's one, a constitutional history curriculum change, which always makes me a little nervous, by Mr. Keller, Senator, or House Member Keller, that looks a little benign at this point, but that, if anybody that's kept up with education, that's been a big one in the state of Texas with changing the way history has been written. So that will be interesting. Of course, Mr. Keller has been accused many, many times of being sort of in the cohorts of the ALEC Corporation, that is crafting legislation from outside. So that's it. There is some pre-kindergarten school program plans. The governor did put some money in education for pre-K, which is very, very gratifying to see. Very happy he's a supporter of that. So there's, if you go to the Alaska Basis database there, and you can check out all of the bills that are out there. You can click on them. They'll tell you exactly what they are. They have some sponsor statements of why they're doing it. You can even sign up to track them and have them send you updates when they move from committees. So there's a lot of tools in the toolbox if you want to follow education.
Follow what's happening.
And it's a huge part of our economy here. Biggest employer of the whole borough is the school district. Mm-hmm. For a lot of schools, a lot of information out there, and a big part of our budget. So we should be watching it. So that little bit, I guess I should say, before we close up, there is an assembly meeting next Tuesday. Mm-hmm. The packet is not out yet.
Oh.
I went through the introductions just to see, really, there's not anything too huge on there. Although the mayor did let everybody know that he intends to bring forward many, many resolutions in support to what the Valley delegation is doing in Juneau. It's unclear what that what those are. I, of course, my favorite is to refer to them as memos to myself, because that's kind of what they are, is just say, you go, boy, type thing. So we don't know what those are. They, by deadline, will be posted by later today on the borough website.
That's good.
And the school board will meet the day after, on the 20th of February, and not a lot there either. There was only one non-action item, and that was the legislative priorities and the capital request. So they'll probably go through that. Of course, Radio Free Palmer will live stream both those meetings. So we'll probably see a little bit more when that happens.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's there's so much that's happening. I appreciate this focus today on the educational topic, because you're right. It's the big one. It's the one that affects probably more than any other action of the legislature that affects directly what's going on here in the valley and reaches into all parts of the valley.
Right, and there's been so much outside conversation on this, and there's so many states that are so far ahead of us on some very successful changes and some really bad changes. And Alaska, has the benefit to learn from those. Mm-hmm. And not only do legislators learn from those, but the people learn, and they do their homework, and they come to the table with different ideas. So we're really lucky in that, if we can take a very kind of a methodical way of looking at this and not rush into anything. I think Matsu, of all the school districts, is so far ahead in that we offer so much choice, 45 schools, and 11 of them being all, alternative or non-traditional schools. That's a pretty good ratio for 17,500 kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Very impressive. Well, tomorrow, of course, we'll do the Valley Edition and have a chance for perhaps some of the new information that's come out. And we'll be talking with Zaz Hollander, Terry Snyder, and Mark Kelsey.
Right. So the Frontiersman has had some great articles in it this week, so we'll have a lot to talk about, I think.
Oh, yeah. Looking forward to it. All right. Well, have a good week, and we'll see you back next Thursday. The Citizen Lobbyist will return.